Vimes opened his door to see what all the shouting was about down in the office. The corporal manning, or in this case dwarfing, the desk, was having trouble.
"Again? How many times have you been killed this week?"
"I was minding my own business," said the unseen complainer.
"Stacking garlic? You're a vampire, aren't you? I mean, let's see what jobs you've been doing. Post-sharpener for a fencing firm? Sunglasses tester for Argus opticians? Is it me, or is there some underlying trend here?"
"Excuse me, Commander Vimes?"
Vimes looked round into a smiling face that sought only to do good in the world, even if the world had other things it wanted done.
"Ah, constable visit. Yes," he said hurriedly. "At the moment, I'm afraid I'm rather busy, and I'm not even sure that I have got an immortal soul. So perhaps you could call again when—"
"It's about those words you asked me to check," said Visit reproachfully.
"What words?"
"The ones Father Tubalcheck wrote in his own blood. You said to try and find out what they meant."
"Oh, yes, come into my office."
Vimes relaxed. This wasn't going to be another one of those painful conversations about the state of his soul and the necessity of giving it a wash and brush up before eternal damnation set in. This was going to be about something important.
"It's ancient Cenotine, sir. It's out of one of their holy books, although, of course, when I say holy, it is a fact that they were basically misguided in a—"
"Yes, yes, I'm sure," said Vimes, sitting down. "Does it by any chance say Mr. X did it, rah, rah, rah?"
"No, sir. That phrase does not appear anywhere in any known holy book, sir."
"Ah," said Vimes.
"Besides, I looked at other documents in the room, and the paper does not appear to be in the deceased's handwriting, sir."
Vimes brightened up.
"Aha! Someone else's. Does it say something like, 'Take that, you bastard, we've been waiting ages to get you for what you did all those years ago?"
"No, sir. That phrase also does not appear in any holy book anywhere," said Constable Visit, and hesitated.
"Except in the Apocrypha to the Vengeful Testament of Offler," he added conscientiously.
"These words are from the Cenotine Book of Truth," he sniffed, "as they called it. It's what their false god—"
"Could I just perhaps have the words and leave out the comparative religion?" said Vimes.
"Very well, sir."
Visit looked hurt, but unfolded a piece of paper and sniffed disparagingly.
"These are some of the rules that their god allegedly gave to the first people after he'd baked them out of clay, sir. Rules like, 'Thou shalt labour fruitfully all the days of your life, sir,' and 'Thou shalt not kill,' and 'Thou shalt be humble,' that sort of thing."
"Is that all?" said Vimes.
"Yes, sir," said Visit.
"They're just religious quotations?"
"Yes, sir."
"Any idea why it was in his mouth? Poor devil looked like he was having a last cigarette."
"No, sir."
"I could understand it if it was one of the smite your enemies ones," said Vimes. "But that's just saying, 'Get on with your work and don't make trouble.'"
"Senor was rather a liberal god, sir, not big on commandments."
"Sounds almost decent as gods go."
Visit looked disapproving. "The Cenotines died through 500 years of waging some of the bloodiest wars on the continent, sir."
"Spare the thunderbolt and spoil the congregation, eh?" said Vimes.
"Pardon, sir?"
"Oh, nothing. Well, thank you, Constable. I'll see that Captain Carrot is informed, and thank you once again. Don't let me keep you from—"
Vimes's desperately accelerating voice was too late to prevent Visit pulling a roll of paper out of his breastplate.
"I've brought you the latest Unadorned Facts magazine, sir, and also this month's Battle Call, which contains many articles that I'm sure will be of interest to you, including Pastor Nasal Peddler's exhortation to the congregation to rise up and speak to people sincerely through their letterboxes, sir."
Thank you.
I can't help noticing that the pamphlets and magazines I gave you last week are still on your desk, where I left them, sir."
"Oh, yes, well, sorry, you know how it is. The amount of work these days makes it so hard to find the time to—"
"It's never too soon to contemplate eternal damnation, sir."
"I think about it all the time, Constable. Thank you."
Unfair, thought Vimes, when Visit had gone. A note is left at the scene of a crime in my town, and does it have the decency to be a death threat?
No.
The last dying scrawl of a man determined to name his murderer? No. It's a bit of religious doggerel. What's the good of clues that are more mysterious than the mystery? He scribbled a note on Visit's translation and chucked it into his in-tray. Too late, Angua remembered why she avoided the slaughterhouse district at this time of the month. She could change at will at any time, that's what people forgot about werewolves, but they remembered the important thing. Full moonlight was the irresistible trigger. The lunar rays reached down into the centre of her morphic memory and flipped all the switches, whether she wanted them switched or not. Full moon was only a couple of days away, and the delicious smell of the penned animals and the blood from the slaughterhouses was chiming against her strict vegetarianism. The clash was bringing on her PLT. She glared at the shadowy building in front of her.
"I think we'll go round the back," she said, "and you can knock."
"Me? They won't take any notice of me," said Cheery.
"You show them your badge and tell them you're the watch."
"They'll ignore me. They'll laugh at me."
"You're going to have to do it sooner or later. Go on."
The door was opened by a stout man in a bloody apron. He was shocked to have his belt grabbed by one dwarf hand while another dwarf hand was thrust in front of his face, holding a badge, and a dwarf voice in the region of his navel said,
"We're the watch, right? Oh yes, and if you don't let us in, we'll have your guts for starters."
"Good try," murmured Angua. She lifted Cheery out of the way and smiled brightly at the butcher. "Mr. Sock, we'd like to speak to an employee of yours, Mr. Dorful." The man hadn't quite got over Cheery, but he managed to rally,
"Mr. Dorful? What's he done now?"
"We'd just like to talk to him. May we come in?"
Mr. Sock looked at Cheery, who was trembling with nerves and excitement.
"I have a choice," he said.
"Let's say you have a kind of choice," said Angua. She tried to close her nostrils against the beguiling miasma of blood. There was even a sausage factory on the premises. It used all the bits of animals no one would ever otherwise eat or even recognize. The odors of the abattoir turned her human stomach, but deep inside, part of her sat up and drooled and begged at the mingling smells of the pork and beef and lamb and mutton and...
"Rat?" she said, sniffing.
"I didn't know you supplied the dwarf market, Mr. Sock."
Mr. Sock was suddenly a man who wished to be seen to be cooperative.
"Dorful, come here right now."
There was the sound of footsteps and a figure emerged from behind a rack of beef carcasses. Some people had a thing about the undead. Angua knew Commander Vimes was uneasy in their presence, although he was getting better these days. People always needed someone to feel superior to. The living hated the undead, and the undead loathed, she felt her fists clench, the unalive. The golem called Dorful lurched a little because one leg was slightly shorter than the other. It didn't wear any clothes because there was nothing whatever to conceal, and so she could see the mottling on it where fresh clay had been added over the years. There was so much patching that she wondered how old it could be. Originally some attempt had been made to depict human musculature, but the repairs had nearly obscured these. The thing looked like the kind of pots Igneous despised, the ones made by people who thought that because it was handmade it was supposed to look as if it was handmade, and that thumbprints baked in the clay were a sign of integrity. That was it. The thing looked handmade. Of course, over the years it had mostly made itself, one repair at a time. Its triangular eyes glowed faintly. There were no pupils, just the dark red glow of a banked fire. It was holding a long, heavy cleaver. Cheery's stare gravitated to this and remained fixed on it in terrified fascination. The other hand grasped a piece of string, on the end of which was a large, hairy, and very smelly goat.
"What are you doing, Dorful?"
The golem nodded towards the goat.
"Feeding the Eudas goat?"
Dorful nodded again.
"Have you got something to do, Mr. Sock?" said Angua.
"No, I've—"
"You have got something to do, Mr. Sock," said Angua emphatically.
"Huh? Yes, okay. I'll just go and see to the offal boilers."
As the butcher walked away, he stopped to wave a finger under the place where Dorful's nose would be if the golem had had a nose.
"If you've been causing trouble," he began.
"I expect those boilers could really do with attention," said Angua sharply. He hurried off.
There was silence in the yard, although the sounds of the city drifted in over the walls. From the other side of the slaughterhouse there was the occasional bleat of a worried sheep. Dorful stood stock still, holding his cleaver and looking down at the ground.
"Is it a troll made to look like a human?" whispered Cheery. "Look at those eyes."
"It's not a troll," said Angua. "It's a golem, a man of clay. It's a machine."
"It looks like a human?"
"That's because it's a machine made for looking like a human."
She walked around behind the thing.
"I'm going to read your chem, Dorful," she said. The golem let go of the goat and raised the cleaver and brought it down sharply onto a chopping block beside Cheery, making the dwarf leap sideways. Then it pulled around a slate that was slung over its shoulder on a piece of string, unhooked the pencil, and wrote,
"Yes."
When Angua put her hand up, Cheery realized that there was a thin line across the golem's forehead. To her horror, the entire top of the head flipped up. Angua, quite unperturbed, reached inside. Her hand came out holding a yellowing scroll. The golem froze. The eyes faded. Angua unrolled the paper.
"Some kind of holy writing," she said. "It always is. Some old dead religion."
"You've killed it?"
"No, you can't take away what isn't there."
She put the scroll back and closed the head with a click. The golem came alive again, the glow returning to its eyes. Cheery had been holding her breath. It came out in a rush.
"What did you do?"
she managed.
"Tell her, Dorful," said Angua.
The golem's thick fingers were a blur as the pencil scratched across the slate.
"I am a golem. I was made of clay. My life is the words. By means of words of purpose in my head, I acquire life. My life is to work. I obey all commands. I take no rest."
"What words of purpose?"
"Relevant texts that are the focus of belief. Golem must work. Golem must have a master."
The goat lay down beside the golem and started to chew cud.
"There have been two murders," said Angua. "I'm pretty certain a golem did one, and probably both. Can you tell us anything, Dorful?"
"Sorry, look," said Cheery. "Are you telling me this thing is powered by words? I mean, is it telling me it's powered by words?"
"Why not? Words do have power. Everyone knows that," said Angua. "There are more golems around than you might think. They're out of fashion now, but they last. They can work underwater, or in total darkness, or knee-deep in poison, for years. They don't need rest or feeding. They—"
"But that's slavery," said Cheery.
"Of course it isn't. You might as well enslave a doorknob. Have you got anything to tell me, Dorful?"
Cheery kept looking at the cleaver in the block. Words like length and heavy and sharp were filling her head more snugly than any words could have filled the clay skull of the golem. Dorful said nothing.
"How long have you been working here, Dorful?" "Now 300 days already."
"And you have time off?"
"To make a hollow laughing, what would I do with time off?"
"I mean, you're not always in the slaughterhouse."
"Sometimes I make deliveries."
"And meet other golems?"
"Now listen, Dorful, I know you things keep in touch somehow, and if a golem is killing real people, I wouldn't give a busted teacup for your chances. Folk will be along here straight away with flaming torches and sledgehammers, you get my drift?"
The golem shrugged.
"They cannot take away what does not exist," it wrote.
Angua threw up her hands. "I'm trying to be civilized," she said. "I could confiscate you right now. The charge would be being obstructive when it's been a long day and I've had enough." "Do you know Father Tubalcheck?"
"The old priest who lives on the bridge."
"How come you know him?"
"I have made deliveries there."
"He's been murdered. Where were you when he was killed?"
"In the slaughterhouse."
"How do you know?"
Dorful hesitated a moment. Then the next words were written very slowly, as if they had come from a long way away after a great deal of thought.
"Because it is something that must have happened not long ago, because you are excited. For the last 3 days I have been working here."
"All the time?"
"Yes."
24 hours a day?"
"Yes. Men and trolls here on every shift, they will tell you. During the day I must slaughter, dress, quarter, joint and bone, and at night without rest I must make sausages and boil up the livers, hearts, tripes, kidneys, and chitterlings."
"That's awful," said Cheery.
The pencil blurred briefly. "Close." Dorful turned his head slowly to look at Angua and wrote, "Do you need me further?"
"If we do, we know where to find you."
"I am sorry about the old man."
"Good. Come on, Cheery."
They felt the golem's eyes on them as they left the yard.
"It was lying," said Cheery.
"Why'd you say that?"
"It looked as if it was lying."
"You're probably right," said Angua, "but you can see the size of the place. I bet we wouldn't be able to prove it had stepped out for half an hour. I think I'll suggest that we put it under what Commander Vimes calls special surveillance."
"What, like plain clothes?"
"Something like that," said Angua carefully.
"Funny to see a pet goat in a slaughterhouse, I thought," said Cheery, as they walked on through the fog.
"What?" "Oh, you mean the Eudes goat," said Angua. "Most slaughterhouses have one. It's not a pet. I suppose you could call it an employee."
"Employee? What kind of job could it possibly do?"
"Huh. Walk into the slaughterhouse every day. That's its job. Look, you've got a pen full of frightened animals, right? And they're milling around and leaderless. And there's this ramp into the building, looks very scary. And hey, there's this goat. It's not scared, and so the flock follows it, and..." Angua made a throat-slitting noise. "Only the goat walks out."
"That's horrible."
"I suppose it makes sense from the goat's point of view. At least it does walk out," said Angua.
"How did you know about all this?"
"Oh, you pick up all sorts of odds and ends of stuff in the watch."
"I've got a lot to learn, I can see," said Cheery. "I never thought you had to carry bits of blanket for a start."
"It's special equipment if you're dealing with the undead."
"Well, I knew about garlic and vampires. Anything holy works on vampires. What else works on werewolves?"
Sorry, said Angua, who was still thinking about the golem.
"I've got a silver mail vest which I promised my family I'd wear, but is anything else good for werewolves?"
"A gin and tonic's always welcome," said Angua distantly.
"Angua?"
"Hmm? Yes, what?"
"Someone told me there was a werewolf in the watch. I can't believe that."
Angua stopped and stared down at her.
"I mean, sooner or later, the wolf comes through," said Cheery. "I'm surprised Commander Vimes allows it."
"There is a werewolf in the watch, yes," said Angua.
"I knew there was something odd about Constable Visit."
Angua's jaw dropped.
"He always looks hungry," said Cheery, "and he's got that odd smile all the time. I know a werewolf when I see one."
"He does look a bit hungry, that's true," said Angua. She couldn't think of anything else to say.
"Well, I'm going to be keeping my distance."
"Fine," said Angua.
"Angua?"
"Yes?"
"Why do you wear your badge on a collar round your neck?"
"What? Oh, well, so it's, always handy, you know, in any circumstances."
"Do I need to do that?"
"I shouldn't think so."
Mr. Sock jumped.
"Dorful, you damn stupid lump! Never sneak up behind a man on the bacon slicer. I've told you that before. Try to make some noise when you move, damn you."
The golem held up its slate, which said, "Tonight I cannot work."
"What's this? The bacon slicer never asks for time off."
"It is a holy day." Sock looked at the red eyes. Old Fishbein had said something about this, hadn't he, when he'd sold Dorful? Something like, "Sometimes it'll go off for a few hours because it's a holy day. It's the words in its head. If it doesn't go and trot off to its temple or whatever it is, the words'll stop working. Don't ask me why, there's no point in stopping it." $530 the thing had cost. He thought it was a bargain. And it was a bargain, no doubt about that. The damn thing only ever stopped working when it had run out of things to do. Sometimes not even then, according to the stories. You heard about golems flooding out houses because no one told them to stop carrying water from the well, or washing the dishes until the plates were as thin as paper. Stupid things, but useful, if you kept your eye on them. And yet he could see why no one seemed to keep them for long. It was the way the damned two-handed engine just stood there, taking it all in and putting it where, and never complained or spoke at all. A man could get worried about a bargain like that and feel mightily relieved when he was writing out a receipt for the new owner.
"Seems to me there's been a lot of holy days lately," said Sock.
"Sometimes are more holy than others." But they couldn't skive off, could they? Work was what a golem did.
"'I don't know how we're going to manage,' Sock began.
"'It is a holy day.'
"'Oh, all right, you can have time off tomorrow.'
"'Tonight. Holy day starts at sunset.'
"'Be back quickly, then,' said Sock weakly, "'or I'll... you be back quickly, do you hear?'
That was another thing. You couldn't threaten the creatures. You certainly couldn't withhold their pay, because they didn't get any. You couldn't frighten them. Fishbein had said that a weaver over Knapp Hillway had ordered his golem to smash itself to bits with a hammer, and it had.
"'Yes, I hear.'
In a way, it didn't matter who they were. In fact, their anonymity was part of the whole business. They thought themselves part of the march of history, the tide of progress, and the wave of the future. They were men who felt that the time had come. Regimes can survive barbarian hordes, crazed terrorists, and hooded secret societies, but they're in real trouble when prosperous and anonymous men sit around a big table and think thoughts like that. One said,
"At least it's clean this way. No blood.
And it would be for the good of the city, of course."
They nodded gravely. No one needed to say that what was good for them was good for Ankh-Morpork.
"And he won't die?"
Apparently he can be kept merely unwell. The dosage can be varied, I'm told.
"Good. I'd rather have him unwell than dead. I wouldn't trust Vetinari to stay in a grave."
"I've heard that he once said he'd prefer to be cremated, as a matter of fact."
"Then I just hope they scatter the ashes really widely, that's all."
"What about the watch?"
"What about it?"
"Ah."
Lord Vetinari opened his eyes. Against all rationality, his hair ached. He concentrated, and a blur by the bed focused into the shape of Samuel Vimes.
"Ah, Vimes," he said weakly. "How are you feeling, sir?" "Truly dreadful. Who was that little man with the incredibly bandy legs?"
"That was Donut Jimmy, sir. He used to be a jockey on a very fat horse."
"A racehorse?"
"Apparently, sir. A fat racehorse? Surely that could never win a race." "I don't believe it ever did, sir, but Jimmy made a lot of money by not winning races." "Ah, he gave me milk and some sort of sticky potion,"
Vetinari concentrated.
"I was heartily sick."
"So I understand, sir."
"Funny phrase, that, heartily sick. I wonder why it's a cliché. Sounds jolly. Rather cheerful, really."
"Yes, sir."
"Feel like I've got a bad dose of the flu, Vimes. Head not working properly."
"Really, sir?"
The patrician thought for a while. There was obviously something else on his mind.
"Why did he still smell of horses, Vimes?" he said at last.
"He's a horse doctor, sir, a damn good one. I heard last month he treated Dire Fortune and it didn't fall over until the last furlong."
"Doesn't sound helpful, Vimes?"
"Oh, I don't know, sir. The horse had dropped dead coming up to the starting line."
"Ah, I see. Well, 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 what a nasty, suspicious mind you have, Vimes. Thank you, sir."
The patrician raised himself on his elbows.
"Should toenails throb, Vimes?"
"Couldn't say, sir."
"Now I think I should like to read for a while. Life goes on, huh?"
Vimes went to the window. There was a nightmarish figure crouched on the edge of the balcony outside, staring into the thickening fog.
"Everything all right, Constable Downspout?"
"Yes, sir,"
said the apparition.
"I'll shut the window now. The fog is coming in."
"Right you are, sir."
Vimes closed the window, trapping a few tendrils which gradually faded away.
"What was that?"
said Lord Vetinari.
"Constable Downspout's a gargoyle, sir. He's no good on parade and bloody useless on the street, but when it comes to staying in one place, sir, you can't beat him. He's world champion at not moving.
If you want the winner of the 100 metres standing still, that's him. He spent 3 days on a roof in the rain when we caught the Park Lane nobbler. Nothing will get past him. And there's Corporal Gimlitson patrolling the corridor, and Constable Glod's nephew on the floor below, and Constables Flint and Moraine in the rooms on either side of you, and Sergeant Detritus will be around constantly, so that if anyone nods off, he'll kick ass, sir. And you'll know when he does that, because the poor bugger'll come right through the wall.
Well done, Vimes. Am I right in thinking that all my guards are non-human? They all seem to be dwarfs and trolls.
Safest way, sir.
You've thought of everything, Vimes.
Hope so, sir.
Thank you, Vimes.
Vetinari sat up and took a mass of papers off the bedside table.
And now, don't let me detain you.
Vimes' mouth dropped open.
Vetinari looked up. Was there anything else, Commander?
Well, I suppose not, sir. I suppose I'd just better run along, eh?
If you wouldn't mind. And I'm sure a lot of paperwork has accumulated in my office, so if you'd send someone to fetch it, I would be obliged.
Vimes shut the door behind him, a little harder than necessary.
Gods, it made him livid, the way Vetinari turned him on and off like a switch, and had as much natural gratitude as an alligator.
The patrician relied on Vimes doing his job, knew he'd do his job, and that was the extent of his thoughts on the matter.
Well, one day Vimes would bloody well do his job, of course, because he didn't know how to do anything else. But realizing that made it all the worse.
Outside the palace, the fog was thick and yellow. Vimes nodded to the guards on the door and looked out at the clinging, swirling clouds. It was almost a straight line to the watchhouse in Pseudopolis Yard, and the fog had brought early night to the city. Not many people were on the streets. They stayed indoors, barring the windows against the damp shreds that seemed to leak in everywhere.
Yes. Empty streets, a chilly night, dampness in the air.
Only one thing was needed to make it perfect. He sent the sedan man on home and walked back to one of the guards.
You're Constable Lucker, aren't you?
Yes, sir, Sir Samuel.
What size boots do you take?
Lucker looked panicky.
What, sir?
It's a simple question, man.
7½, sir.
From old plugger in new cobblers, the cheap ones?
Yes, sir.
Can't have a man guarding the palace in cardboard boots, said Vimes with mock cheerfulness. Off with them, Constable. You can have mine. They've still got wyvern, well, whatever it is wyverns do, on them, but they'll fit you. Don't stand there with your mouth open. Give me your boots, man. You can keep mine, Vimes added. I've got lots.
The Constable watched, in frightened astonishment, as Vimes pulled on the cheap pair and stood upright, stamping a few times with his eyes shut.
Ah, he said. I'm in front of the palace, right?
Yes, sir. You've just come out of it, sir. It's this big building here.
Ah, said Vimes brightly. But I'd know I was here, even if I hadn't.
It's the flagstones,
said Vimes. They're an unusual size and slightly dished in the middle. Hadn't you noticed?
Your feet, lad, that's what you'll have to learn to think with.
The bemused constable watched him disappear into the fog, stamping happily.